from Vision Australia Radio. It's time to open the cellar door and uncork a classic on Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Hello, I'm Michael Hintz, the velvety voice of Vino, with another Heard It Through the Grapevine. We're on Vision Australia Radio, of course, and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. Great to be with you again. And as that great man, Len Evans, used to say, life's too short to drink bad wine. Hear, hear. And a hello from my producer, Ish Rashad. Today, my guest is the energetic, ebullient Phil Hude, independent wine retailer and effusive wine educator from Armidale Cellars. Phil, welcome to Grapevine.
Hi, Michael.
Now, firstly, tell me a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you got into wine retailing, because it's not an easy pursuit.
It's a tough business, and I think like any retail at the moment, it's extremely challenging, and there's many new paradigms have hit in the last few years since GFC, but I was fortunate enough. I love hospitality. That's the first point. I went to an all-boys Catholic Christian Brothers school, and you know, the joke we always use is they drove me to drink. But love the fact that I got into hospitality via the hotel scene. So I worked for the Target Hotel Group, which owned the Old England Hotel in Heidelberg, and Kramer's Hotel, which was a huge night spot in my day. And a pub opposite Pentridge Prison when it was running. And so that gave me a very down-to-earth style in hospitality to start. I did about 10 years in pubs, so to speak.
Yep.
And in that time, I also managed to do part-time work for a retail store in the northern suburbs.
At Eaglemont, wasn't it?
At Eaglemont, where I cut my teeth and then became manager.
I can still see the old Chewy on the front window.
And, did some radio with Bruce Mansfield, actually.
Oh, with Bruce,
with him, and he was a good client, and we ended up doing some radio stuff with him. But he, long story short, I cut my teeth in wine buying there, which was an interesting store because it was a hidden cul-de-sac, and it was very hard to market it. So what I didn't realise at the time, like a lot of good lessons in life, is that it taught me to make sure to put all the unique selling points of a proposition forward, whether it was a tasting or a wine or whatever. And we worked very hard to get people to Eaglemont. And then I was offered the store by the owners to buy after about 8 or 10 years with them, and chose Armidale instead because it was just opportunity with a capital O, and that was in High Street, Armidale. So I began that tenure about roughly 18 years ago.
Now, they've reduced the speed limit down to 40. Is that a conspiracy by the retailers to say, and we want 30 kilometres an hour? Is that a conspiracy to get people to stop and watch call in?
Considering at one stage it was going to be a thoroughfare and no parking whatsoever.
Really? Oh, that's right.
A big thing when I...
that was under Brumby's, in Brumby's day, wasn't it?
They had everyone up in arms. And but pretty simply, the 40 thing for us has been, I think, a good, it's been a boon. And has led people to be, I think, to look at the store more, which is great. So use of A-frames and signage has really got to be on the ball. And but that's the joy of being a retailer. You wear a lot of hats, and as a micro retailer as I am, you wear a lot of hats, and it is a matter of getting all the different aspects of the price promotions and all those, marketing terms right, so that customer keeps coming.
Now, when you say a micro retailer, you mean you're an independent retailer? Because when a lot of people think of buying their wine, they don't think too much about it. They probably just buy on price and they go to the big supermarkets. But that's not the space you inhabit, is it? Because there are so many wines producing. What are the rough figures that go through supermarkets and what's left for the smaller producers?
Yeah, in the time... I might add that the other important aspect that I took on was to part-time while I was working in hotels and then part-time in wine stores. I completed the University of Adelaide wine marketing diploma, which...
At Roseworthy,
at Roseworthy, yep, was Roseworthy in my day. It's been gobbled up by the University of Adelaide now.
Waite Campus or something, yeah.
And they hold most of their stuff at Waite Campus, unlike the old days when it was at Roseworthy College in
which
the north.
Which was lovely old building.
It was gorgeous. And it is probably, it is the most, decorated uni for wine...
Oh, and enology, yes, because you look at the graduates out of there, it's a who's who of the industry, isn't it?
Yeah, and it taught me a lot. I mean, in my day when I did it 20 years ago or so, it was extremely winemaking based as well as marketing. Now it's very puristic marketing. So I'm glad I did it when I did it.
Yeah.
And I knew I didn't want to be exactly, you know, a winemaker as such. I just love this. I love sales. I'm an unashamed salesperson. And did want to be a real estate agent or a stockbroker. So I thought, what should I do? I love wine, and that was my passion. And I developed that passion over time. So to go backwards, you're right. Nowadays, the chains, the two big chains, have taken a really large share of the market, roughly about 85% to 87%, depending on who you read.
So that leaves, from all the small producers, wine producers out there, of whom there are, what, 1,200, 1,500, 2,000?
It'll be a few thousand at least. And, you know, the incredible statistic I read not long ago was there's a new winery develops in Australia every 3 days, which is quite staggering. And that's simply a lot because, you know, they've been growers for large companies and they've had their contract torn up or stopped and they've had to be shadow themselves.
Well, that's a saying in the industry, isn't it? How do you make a small fortune?
Yeah.
Start with a big one, isn't it?
How do you make $1 million out there? It's the old Napa Valley joke. Yeah. How do you make $1 million out of a Napa Valley winery? Start with $10 million.
Yeah.
And part of that, you know, is here. There are a lot of people in the industry. Levantine Hill, the Gerasati family, just recently put $30 million into a Cellar Door facility and what is an incredible showpiece at the Yarra Valley.
That's the Ezard. That's the combined Cellar Door and restaurant, isn't it? Three Ezards up there.
Absolutely
at
stunning.
Coldstream.
And you know, he's arguably employed one of the best winemakers in, or if not the best in Yarra Valley.
That's Paul Bridgman. Yes,
And you know, they've got a really distinct philosophy, but you know that's taken a lot of effort and money that they'll never see the ROI within their lifetime or.
That's return on investment.
Exactly right. That's an accounting term.
It's not a new footballer for my football team.
You know, pretty simply, it's people like that who are driving, passionate. And I think that's what the hospitality and the wine industry especially is about. It's about people with passion and complete, want to do the best. And that drives the whole thing and makes it fantastic, I think, for consumers.
So your outlet really is a mecca for the smaller producers, smaller independent producers, rather than the large conglomerates where you can get their wine anywhere. But people that go to you would want wines from upmarket or unusual producers who usually make a small amount of wine.
And I would put forward, there's the craftsmanship style and the boutique, as you say, rightly.
Yeah.
There's no doubt in my mind that, in all realms of the industry, there's the distinctly large players that hold a large percentage of the market, whether it's grape growers, retail, wine stores, wineries. Then pretty simply there's the niche players, and that's where we like to think we are in wine retail. And then everyone between is certainly stuck in the middle, and that's an old Michael Porter strategic marketing gag.
Yes.
But pretty simply, you know, there's no doubt that we educate, we give lots of different aspects towards the just wine buying process where it's not just a simple, here's a plethora of labels, try and choose. For us, it's all about service and quality and, I think, most people who want to choose a great wine want to have an idea of what's going on and want to have an idea of what's special and what's new. And
as you climb up the price wine wall, I mean, you have obviously good house specials you get, and there's some great wines. I buy some myself. But as you climb up the wine wall and to the more expensive wines, people want to know about the provenance and the stories and the maker and all those sort of things. And that's where you come in, isn't it?
I think we, there's no doubt in my mind we have key producers that we've listed on our site that we've had long-term relationships with, and I think that's part of it. Like you say, the story is significant, but also the fact that there are certain people within the industry, whether it's people like Gioconda or Wild Duck Creek, who have, proven over a long period of time that they're very good at what they do and they're consistent and they consistently deliver top, quality, and that's really where we're at. And from our point of view, I mean, there's so many wines to choose from. And then, of course, we can go outside Australia, of course, and have a lot of overseas
imported wines
as well.
Yes.
So it's a it's a never-ending pursuit, and it's like philosophy and religion. There is no end game in some respects. It's just a continuum.
Yeah, it's like Hinduism, doesn't it, in a way? And it absorbs everything else like a big sponge.
Yeah.
And, you know, it accommodates. But has anyone ever counted how many different wine labels there would be on the shelves? I mean, if you look at one winery who does about 10 or 12 different lines of wine, and then you multiply that by, it's just staggering, isn't it?
It is. And one of the new paradigms is BOBs, or buyer's own brands within retail. And, you know, we've got our own house label as well, the Toodle and Buster label. And
Woof!
Yeah, the Woof, the dogs.
Down, Buster.
And we've got the two dogs, Toodle the Poodle and Buster the Labrador.
Yes.
And, but pretty simply, that's a big thing for the chains as well, creating their own brands and marketing their own brands.
Critter labels, they call them in the States, don't they?
Yes, that's right. Mm. And that's become a big part. But again, you know, for us, it's we love to support entities that exist in high quality entities. And, you know, the beauty is that there are new entrants like Levantine Hill and other people who make it interesting. And, you know, it's, again, never ending. It's just a fantastic pursuit.
Yeah, and you do the same for imported wines. You have the same philosophy, don't you?
Correct, yeah. We had a German tasting last night with the Birkeland Wolf people up the road in High Street at a restaurant and had a great time with them. And, you know, it's a matter of the old world's as exciting as the new world. It's
And you go to, don't you go to Vinitalia every year? Is that,
well, it's every two or three years, and you've got to be lucky enough to be, you can either be sponsored or make the trip yourself. And I'm being fortunate enough to be sponsored by the Italian government this year to go across to Verona.
Bellissimo. Oh,
yeah, which is fantastic.
And And how many, where's it held?
In Verona, something like 4,000 producers from Italy and across the world, but, you know, the prominently Italian.
Yep.
I show roughly about 10,000 wines in a four-day festival. So it's pretty refreshing.
And, pretty refreshing.
Yeah, no, it's a,
how
it's
does
a...
your palate stand that? How do you come back?
I need a few days in London to watch the soccer to recuperate, I can tell you.
Who do you support in
soccer
in London?
I'm a mad QPR fan, but who aren't doing that
QPR,
well at the moment.
QPR, what a pity. Go Spurs.
Yeah, they're an offset to my Hawthorn boys who are doing very well.
Okay. Now, wine retailing has changed so quickly, and we're having a chat before we came on air about the impact of social media, because you were going to say that you were going to have some help just to have someone handle the social media side of
that. Yeah, we've
tell us all about the development of that.
And again, that's a new paradigm, you know, in the last few years that we've had to adopt. And you know, I did my thesis at Roseworthy to the benefits of the internet to the wine industry when the internet was extremely infantile in this country. And but social media has just been an incredible phenomenon, and, you know, Instagram's sort of taking over from Twitter, and Facebook's huge, and there's new ways and means to get to the client nowadays. And, you know, email's almost becoming passe, and, you know, we're sort of looking at whether mail, as in mail, you know, is sort of a way to actually make people really stand up and notice you. Because there's so few people doing
it.
Yeah, it's quite amazing how things, fashions turn around. But social media is a new phenomenon that, you know, really does engage a lot of different age groups, but all age groups in some respect, and makes it accessible. And then we do YouTube videos with some of the winemakers that we put on our website, which is really interesting.
There are all sorts of wines coming from Spain and Italy now with unpronounceable names, aren't there? There's you deserve a medal, a drink just about to pronounce some of the names. But we've come a long way, because people seem to forget that the history of table wine in Australia is relatively short. It was only about the mid-60s, late 50s, mid-60s, that everything took off. So
exactly.
We're very spoiled for what we can get in Australia, aren't
Well,
we?
No doubt. I mean, and that's the thing about being in wine retail, that it is a pretty exhaustive regime. We try about 5 to 50 wines every day on the tasting table.
5 to 50 every day. And you've got to keep up with these trends,
absolutely,
haven't you?
And it is quite mind-numbing. I constantly get a phone call from someone who's tried a label that I've never heard of, which is, again, you know, not unusual, because there is just there's such a plethora of labels, and the world's getting smaller and faster to get things from overseas, which is, you know, good in a way.
Now, Australian Pinots have come a long way. It's taken about 25, 30 years. We're starting to master Pinot.
It's a great Pinot.
There's some really good stuff. But what about some of what's trending in wine at the moment in reds and whites?
Pinot.
Because wine's like fashion, isn't it?
Yes, it is. There's absolutely no doubt. And I think without being lost in our grandeur, we tend to be on the cutting edge of that. Yeah. Because we have the ability, you know, the hinterland that we have and the people around us have the money, God bless them, to indulge in, you know, high-end, what is the fashion coming up. So Pinot is certainly fashionable. I'm noticing that Cabernet Shiraz blends are becoming fashionable because how do you market and get rid of Cabernet, so to speak, because that is unfashionable.
Is it?
It is, unfortunately, and yet everyone who loves wine knows. Great Cabernet is great. Mm. And then to go backwards, you know, let's look at Margaret River, which, frightfully, I'm older than viticulturally.
Yes, yes.
Because it's only really since the 70s that Margaret River has been producing, you know, table wine in any real quantity.
Yep.
So, you know, you're right. It's a really embryonic industry in a large way, even though there might be people in the Barossa and Rutherglen who have got aged vines. But, you know, compared to the old world, we're really on, you know, the launch pad. And that's what makes it so exciting, because somewhere like Margaret River is extremely high quality. I mean, you know, the Cullens and Mosswoods of the world and Howard Parks are just spectacular.
Yeah, and what's the other one there? It's built like a, not Howard
Park. Lewin Estate. There's so many.
Voyager
Estate. I mean, there's just incredible amount of money. Again, there's a classic example, Margaret River, of a place where a lot of people have really put their, you know, passion and money from other industries into something else.
Very
into
pristine the wine over there, isn't it? There's some fantastic
incredible,
wineries.
Incredible place to visit.
Mm.
So those things are fashionable. You know, we always like to think of the industry, Riesling is coming back, and to some degree
but
it
never,
is.
Never really goes away. It's got such a magnificent profile,
Riesling, isn't it?
It
has. Sauvignon Blanc starting to drop off. We're noticing Pinot Grigio / Gris, same thing, but, you know, is trending.
Now, what is the difference between Pinot Grigio and Pinot Gris?
Nothing.
Or is there a difference?
Same grape, but again, you know, there's always clonal differences, but the reality is that if you're of Italian background, like the boys and girls in the King Valley, obviously you're going to say you're Pinot Grigio, but if you're a Francophile, maybe down in the Mornington Peninsula, and you may tend to think that, you know, Pinot Gris is better, and that is a philosophy that comes out of the winemaking style, usually between Gris and Grigio as well.
Yes, yeah. And what other whites are starting to? Of course, Chardonnay. Shiraz is like the opera house of wines in Australia, isn't it? Everybody has a good Shiraz.
Shiraz is, I can't believe in my lifetime Shiraz will be knocked off top perch. But
And
certainly Chardonnay is coming back. And
is it?
Yeah, I think we're starting to get it very right in terms of our oak usage and the way and the style of Chardonnay in this country. You know, we went through that stage of
that early days when we had to learn how to handle wood. Then there were those buttery concoctions.
I think Chardonnay now has, especially again, let's take Margaret River and the Yarra Valley as two prime examples, and then obviously in my mind the king of Chardonnays is Gioconda from Beechworth, which as an area again is evolving greatly. You know, there's some very exciting places, and they'll continue to come. You know, places like even Mount Gambier are starting to show a bit of interest.
Beechworth's very dress circle, isn't it? There aren't many cellar doors there, but gee, there's a lot of individual,
very high
brilliant
quality
wines. Cammock Rodder and there's Eldorado Road and
Castagna and
Piano, even
absolutely
there's all sorts
stunning
of
stuff. And Barry Morey at Sorenberg. There's just
Sorenberg. The old Sorenberg.
Yeah, Sorenberg's fantastic gear. And you know, there really are. It's a special region. Again, we're finding out. This is a very large country, and we tend to forget that as Aussies, that it is such a varied and large country that we can have the ability to have a number of, you know, different regions that have special parts, whether it's Coonawarra or whether it's Margaret River or Mornington Peninsula. There really is a lot of incredible differential between soil types and topography.
Yeah.
And, that, you know, we're making use of that those sites. It's fantastic.
And of course, Tasmania. I had some
absolutely.
What was it? Tollpuddle Pinot the other day.
One of the great, Sean Smith invested a lot of money into the Tollpuddle vineyard, you know, reputedly the greatest vineyard in the Apple Isle. And again, you know, there's people like Samantha Connu at Stargazer and who are just, you know, doing very special things down there. Coal River Valley is
the spot at the
is
moment,
the place,
isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's going to become an area of greatness in a short time. Not that it isn't great already, but there are some people that have been down there a long time, and Domain A, et cetera, who have exploited that region to some degree. But there's no doubt that people will run towards that region, and Tollpuddle again was another another entity that took advantage of that, and it'll just keep coming.
And, of course, they've got some good, marvellous Rieslings coming out of Tasmania too.
Riesling, Pinot and Chardonnay are certainly the forte grapes from that region. And, I can't speak highly enough about some Tasmanian wines. Some of them can be expensive, but I think there are still people there. And this is the pursuit of a wine merchant, to find the ones that we think are special value quality regime.
And, of course, Andrew Perry now is doing some good things with his sparkling at Apogee. He wants to knock Ed Carr off his perch.
That's
I don't know
whether
he does,
yeah.
But, I mean, there's some beautiful sparkling coming out of Tasmania, and it's not all expensive as you think.
No, that's right. And, yeah. And you know, I think, you know, the other one I think that's always worth mentioning, the Teltani people with their Clover Hill facility and make very good sparkling.
Yes.
And, you know, the tough part for the sparkling winemakers in this country is, you know, the degree to which French champagne houses have managed to get their product here at a certain price rate, some of that through, obviously, parallel importing, which is another problem for the industry. But
what is parallel importing? You hear that term?
It's a long story.
Right.
But pretty simply, it's the it's the importation of a product via another channel from another region area. That may therefore have a price preference, therefore the product might not be fresh as it should be.
In other words, it sits on the dock somewhere in
it's a tough one for the industry because it's for the chains especially, they've taken advantage of that. And
yeah, but the Champenois are pretty cunning people. I mean, if you look at a luxury brand, champagne, and they invest a lot of time and solicitor's time too, protecting that brand, don't they?
They do. It's a headache for them as well, but then for maybe the bigger brands, it's a matter of, you know, they're getting market exposure. Are they that worried about it? So that's the interesting argument.
Yeah. And do they have an influence on the restaurant scene where they influence what's known as when you go to a fancy restaurant, first pour, because the diner might say, well, look, what to the sommelier or wine waiter, what would you recommend? And they might be, the waiter might be,
have
some sort of inducement from a few houses.
Yes, well, we're not the only industry that I'm sure that there's interesting inducements go on. But at the same time, I think most sommeliers at high-end establishments are pretty well on the ball with what they're doing and, like myself, are just horribly passionate about what they do. And just taste, you know, through everything as much as they can to come up with a recipe for the best wines. And look, I suppose it comes down to the moral integrity of each operator and each place. But, you know, I think the better restaurants go through a quality regime rather than just taking on a product for its inducement, so to speak, because that can only be short term like any inducement.
Now, the other one, you do a lot of... you're not only a wine merchant and a bon vivant, and you enjoy, but you do a lot of education, and that's an important part. And the way it's done is important because a lot of people get the feeling, or they get a bit put off by wine because there's a lot of snobby, you know, one-upmanship, and you know, you're made to feel. Now that's not the case because I've heard your courses are pretty much. Top of the tree for entertainment and information.
We make them very good fun.
For many years.
They've been very successful and it's a very distinct part of the business. And from our point of view, and I think my start entry into hospitality through the hotel/pub system gave me a distinct realm of the egalitarianism within this country that should be, and that you should always treat people the same. And therefore, you know, wine, as you say, sometimes can be a little bit elitist. It is a very artistic pursuit.
Yes.
And therefore it is interpretive, and therefore everyone has a subjective
opinion. No two palates are the same, are they?
No, that's, you know, we try and that's the whole thing with wine education, is to get through to people that it is an art form and that you can interpret it in your own way. But there are some cues and clues that I think give you the ability to look at a wine in a smart way.
And you make it fun, don't you? I mean, this
Absolutely.
Is if you're not going to drink, you know, the purpose of wine to me is enjoyment for its own sake, but it's sharing and it's having fun, and that's where the Italians
Absolutely.
Have got the march on
hospitality. I think the Europeans in general. But, we do 100 wines in 5 weeks on the introductory wine course, and that's great fun because it allows you to have a wide palate to look at.
Because you get into habits, don't you, with wine? Like you have your favourite food and you have your comfort
Correct.
Food and you default to it. And you're never going to learn unless you sort of push the boat out
get
a bit.
Get outside the box here.
That's even right. For people like me who've been around a while and whose palate might get tired, it's a sort of place that I should go to refresh my palate. And because you need to start again and listen to other people's opinions.
Correct. We have people who've done the course 2 and 3 times for that exact reason, because no course is exactly the same, because seasonality will obviously dictate and fashion that there will be changes. But, we have great fun with them, and we're never any pursuits for those, and champagne challenges and Shiraz Grange challenges and all sorts of things that you know, fill our life and nights full of good fun with wine.
I always thought people drove Grange Rovers, and they tell me it's not a Grange Rover, it's a Range Rover around the... You can see a lot of Range Rovers in High Street. You can't see behind them, though. You know, in front of them, you get behind
there,
one of those.
There are a few four-wheel big Touareg tractors, I think is the term I've heard them called. But
yep.
There's no doubt, look, you know, I'm fortunate to be in the hinterland I'm in because obviously there are people who can indulge. But look, we draw our database from all over, not just Melbourne, but Australia. And
you shouldn't be feeling put on or you know, if you can't afford the prices some people pay, you can still get a wine at every sort of price point, can't you?
No doubt.
It's a quality
wine.
No doubt.
We have wines from, you know, that are very accessible and affordable,
yep,
right through to the top premium, because the idea of a good wine merchant, again, is to have wines at all price points that should suit an occasion and or a food type.
Yes, and there are some wine shops you go into around town, you feel, even I feel a bit intimidated, because you feel as though you there's a compulsion to, if you're not buying a caseload of this and a caseload of that. And
yeah, we certainly would want to make it that way. We always have wines on tasting in lovely yep, Riedel stems in store, and because that's the best way to show great wine. And there's no doubt that from our point of view, it's a matter of assisting and helping, and but let people also wander around and be fascinated by the myriad of labels and wines that you can indulge in.
What's better, Grange or Bin 707?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that's posed quite often, yep, you know, to me about how good Grange is. It's a great wine. Let's start with that. It's a iconic wine. It's probably our most famous wine. Is it worth the money? Well, like everything in life, it's a great brand. Sometimes you have to pay the price, whether it's Rolls Royce or Louis Vuitton handbags. But
it's also when people start investing in wine, that's a different thing.
It is.
And that diminishes the wine supply for us drinkers.
Yeah, that's why the Grange Challenge that we do is a real leveler, yep, in terms of you can, you know, by looking at the wines without seeing what they are, not being influenced by the labels.
Yep.
You can actually determine, you know, the quality within your own palate. And I think there are some $50 and $100 examples that are as good as Grange.
Well, look, Phil, thank you very much for your time today. It's been fascinating talking to you. We'll have to have you back again next year or something to
absolutely
bring us up to date. Thank you very much for your time.
Cheers.
Next week, I'll be talking to the urbane articulate Josh Elias, editor of a marvellous publication which deserves a lot of support and good readership, Alchemy. My research material was sourced from my home library, winebiz.com. And this has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio, heard on all stations around Australia via the Community Radio Network. It's cheers from me, Michael Hintz, and please drink moderately.
Heard It Through the Grapevine is a production of Vision Australia Radio. Sound information.